You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, this is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate, and it starts and ends with an Umberto. Gunned down in Umberto's clam house, Joey Gallo was the best known, though certainly far from the best gangster of his time. His father, Umberto Gallo, sired three sons, Larry, Joe, and Kid Blast. And blast they would through the New York underworld and, in Joey's case, through the national consciousness. Their high watermark was the assassination of Albert Anastasio, real name Umberto, though there's some debate if crazy Joey Gallo really did commit those crimes. Tom Folsom has written The Mad Ones, Crazy Joe Gallo and the Revolution at the Edge of the Underworld. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thank you, Mike.
So set the scene. Here we are. Take us to the corner of 57th and 7th, I think, the Park Sheridan Hotel. Albert Anastasio is getting a haircut. Gunmen burst in. Who are his friends and enemies in the mafia world? Why do they want him dead?
Well, one of my favorite lines is from the guy that owned the toy store at the Park Sheridan place. He said, Albert Anastasia was a man who had a great love for kids. Well, I think this is probably the kindest thing that was ever said on record about Albert Anastasia, the Butcher of Brooklyn and the head of Murder, Inc. Now, Albert Anastasia is hated and feared in South Brooklyn, again, as he's the corporate killing machine for the mafia.
One of his nicknames, what, Lord High Executioner?
The Lord High Executioner. So this is certainly a guy that you don't want to mess with.
Right. And mafia dons, and is he a don of a family at this point?
Yes. Albert Anastasia was a don at this point.
So dons of a family, of course, they can have at their disposal. One of their tools is murder, but it seems like he readily embraced it, perhaps more readily than someone who was being prudent.
Sure. He readily embraced in the sense of that he was literally the guy to go to if the mafia needed to get rid of someone. They were really a policing agent to keep people out of line, especially, you know, some wild characters who would come to fruition, which are the Gallo brothers.
Right.
And these guys, rightly or not, they got the reputation as being the one who whacked Albert Anastasia in the barbershop of the Park Sheridan on November 25th. 1957.
And that was one of the most notorious killings. Photographs of him lying on the floor are in everyone's memory, whoever saw that photograph. In fact, that very photograph was referenced in The Sopranos. I think at one point Tony says, someone is saying to Tony, you know, things used to be more civilized in the old days. And he says, I think I remember a photograph of the Don on the floor.
Yeah, very civilized.
Right. So it may have been Joey Gallo, and it may not have been. But Joey Gallo took credit to bolster his image?
Well, let's kind of set the scene. Joey's in one of his nightclubs on the East Side Nightery Belt here, is what they called it. This is around the East 50s. And this is kind of like these Stork Club knockoffs. So there's kind of very smoky atmosphere. And you've got Joey Gallo, and he looks, he's decked out just like this B-movie gangster. This was one of Joey's, you know, kind of trademarks. He really loved to look like a mobster. So he's with his pals hanging around the bar, and he makes a crack. He says, well, from now on, you could just call us the barbershop quintet. And very readily the word spread that these are the guys that did the job on Anastasia.
Who was Joey Gallo at this point? An up-and-comer, an established guy? Who?
Joey Gallo was an up-and-comer at this point. He was kind of the king of the jukebox industry is what they called it. Being the king is he wasn't actually the guy on top. He was the muscle. So, the jukebox industry, just the fact that there even was a jukebox industry, to me sounds kind of fascinating, that, you know, the jukebox racket. Well, there was a lot of nickels and dimes that were being plunked into this. And Joey Gallo was, he was a strong arm man working for the interests, the criminal interests in regard to the jukebox racket.
So he had two brothers. His older brother is Larry, a little more temperate. He was always, as time would go on, be the negotiator. And his younger brother was nicknamed Kid Blast.
Kid Blast, yes.
Pretty good nickname. And so once Anastasio is killed, where does this put the Gallos?
Well, it really launches their reputation as these are almost the new Murder, Inc. These are the heirs apparent. These are the guys to go to if you need someone worked over. They're the instruments of to keep order within the mafia.
And who gave the order? If it was Gallo who killed him, or actually, I think all of the whoever actually pulled the trigger on the Don, I think everyone agrees that the person who gave the order was who.
Well, there's a lot of speculation. I mean, these are really Shakespearean power plays. A lot of people think it was Carlo Gambino who would eventually take Anastasia's place as the new Don.
He was Anastasia's under Don, and we get the Gambino crime family. That's from his name.
Absolutely. You know, but I mean, one way or another, I mean, Gambino really was the kind of uber godfather of this era. I mean, he was really the puppet master, let's say, of the New York Mafia in the 1960s.
And what about the Profaci's? How do they come into play?
Well, the Profaci family, I think, is really instructive just to immediately think of Don Corleone. They literally called Joe Profaci the olive oil king. He was reputed to be America's largest importer of olive oil. And he had this criminal empire really since, that he'd built since the 1930s. He was one of the first guys on the Underworld Commission. And this is the Profaci family that the Gallo brothers are part of.
And did Profaci, was he possibly the ones who ordered Gallo to do the killing?
Yeah, he certainly would have had a hand in it if the Gallos indeed were the ones that did it.
And so the Gallos then, they did Profaci's dirty work. They wanted their reward.
Sure. Well, they figured, they didn't want to go through the traditional routes. I mean, it's instructive to think of this as a big corporation, as an IBM. And okay. Gals are almost the guys in the mailroom, right? So, they're young upstarts. They're up and coming. But they don't want to wait, for 10, 15 years and slowly work their way up the ranks. They wanted, they were feeling hot. They were the mob stars of the underworld at this point, and they wanted their due. And when they didn't get it, they decided to go take it for themselves.
And this is Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate, and we're speaking with Tom Folsom, whose book is The Mad Ones on WNYC. And what they do seems bold, combined bold and extremely ill-advised, and they don't even execute their plan well. What, a massive kidnapping spree? Tell me what happens.
Yeah, this is, I mean, in terms of a coup, this is almost like the Bay of Pigs of the underworld. This is the Gallo brothers. They reputedly sent out limousines to kidnap the Don's brother, his brother-in-law, the top capos of the Profaci family. And then they're going to hold them all hostage in the Manhattan Hotel. And we'll see what happens then. But, of course, if you're going to go after the Don and all of his other people, you got to make sure you get the Don. Well,
right.
That was the one thing that the Gallos missed. They totally botched the coup because they missed the Don. They couldn't find him.
They got all these lieutenants, all these capos, but without the Don, it would be pointless. So now you've got these guys like Carlo Gambino. He was in the room, right? Did they have is was
well? Well,
the
I mean, these things aren't really recorded in the the minutes in the National Archives here.
So they have supposedly a bunch of guys. Perhaps it was Gambino. What do they do? I mean, how do they get out of it? How do they say, "All right, we're going to let these guys go and try not to get killed? Maybe even try to get some reward from it."
Yeah, that seems to be at the plan. There was some vague agreements made, and one of the scenes is Larry Gallo, who's really the boss of the Gallo gang. He meets a guy at a bar, and this scene is replayed in Godfather 2, when you have all of a sudden a guy gets a rope around his neck in a bar.
I think Luca Brasi is
Frankie Five Angels in Godfather 2, but
Godfather 2.
Basically he's getting strangled to death in a bar. And in walks a cop just by dumb luck.
Right.
And saves him at the last moment. Well, this happened, literally down to the dialogue. They took this scene from what happened to Larry Gallo.
Right. So Luca Brasi was garroted. It was the botched garroting of Frankie Five Angels, who I think winds up killing himself. Right. He said they explained to him this is what a Roman soldiers used to do when they lost honor.
Great line.
Right. So at this point, here we are talking about a gang that couldn't shoot straight, which became the title of Jerry Breslin's book, which was a work of fiction, but very much based on the Gallo brothers. So it's all about bumbling gangsters with quirks, like they traveled around with a little person.
Yes, Mondo the Midget. This was the official Gallo gang mascot. He was around, and he reputedly would walk around the Gallo family lion named Cleo, which they kept in the basement of
let's
Gallo headquarters.
Let's take a second and let's just rewind. The Gallo family lion?
Yes, the Gallo family lion. Well, he might have been the most effective member of the Gallo gang. He was a
he did his job well.
If you have a deadbeat, you very kindly take him to the cellar door, and you. Throw throw down a big hunk of meat, and there's a big roar from the basement, and very quickly this deadbeat decides he's gonna pay up the greens.
Let's talk animal husbandry for a second. How does one acquire and care for a lion in Brooklyn?
Well, it sounds like it was some sort of exotic animal dealer scheme. You know, I'm sure if you want to talk to him, they might be able to get you on if you're interested.
And did the lion survive for a while? Whatever became of the lion?
I heard it was eventually taken to a New Jersey zoo.
Okay. Wow. So the Gallifant, so this gang has a lion. This gang has a little person who, by the way, in the film version of the gang who couldn't shoot straight, was played by Hervé Villechaise.
Yes.
They changed his name to Beppo.
And they actually, and they dub him over with a tough guy Brooklyn accent.
Right. So we know why that movie did really well.
Yeah.
Okay, so far we're painting this picture of a crime family that's not very good at what it does, tries to get theirs, isn't really interesting. And it would have stopped there, and Joey Gallo probably wouldn't have been anyone but a footnote in the ranks of, you know, not very successful gangsters. Except he starts undergoing a transformation. So
right.
When does Joey Gallo begin to sip from the font of wisdom and smoke from the hash pipe of wisdom in Greenwich Village? When does that transformation start?
Well, this is right at the same time when Bob Dylan, who, of course, would later immortalize Joey in his 11-minute ballad, Joey, this is when Joey moves to Greenwich Village in 1961. Now, he's been raised in Red Hook, Brooklyn all of his life, being bred to be part of the establishment. Now, let's think of the establishment as the mafia, because it is very much a corporation of crime here. This is a system. So Joey all of a sudden has this awakening when he comes to Greenwich Village. He wants to paint. He wants to write. He wants to, you know, compose poetry. I heard he's even taking acting classes at some point. So Joey really is becoming a part of this cultural upheaval that's happening on McDougal Street in Greenwich Village. And he's also picking up, you know, in the coffee shops and on the streets, the undercurrent of revolution, which will start to come to fruition. And Joey very much is going to take on the system, which is, in his case, the mafia.
Was there evidence that he was a different kind of thinker as opposed to a hothead before he encountered some of these thoughts and philosophies in Greenwich Village?
Well, he was always a hothead, and he was also, I think, he was also a guy that he wanted to take everything and use it and milk it and manipulate it to his advantage, twist it to his own ends. And he's doing the same thing. He's taking this almost innocent spirit that's, you know, being celebrated by guys like Kerouac, and he's twisting it to his own ends for his own criminal means.
And did he wind up having any sort of coherent philosophy, or was it just sort of a mishmash of rebellion and trying to stick it to the man, sometimes with an actual, you know, gun?
Well, I think in many ways, his story is kind of the trajectory of the dark side of the 60s. And I think at the end, Joey, who's famously gunned down in a Barrett's clam house, learned the lesson the hard way that you can't beat the system.
Did all of the counterculturalism he was steeped in ever lead him to question the fact that, you know, he spilled people's blood for a living? Because there was revolution, but there was also a hippie element of that time.
Well, I mean, listen, if you look at the course of the 60s, you know, there was blood, plenty of blood spilled in the name of revolution. So, I think, I think it's a real tragedy how this spirit could get hijacked and twisted to these terrible ends.
So I'm speaking with Tom Folsom. We're talking about his new book, The Mad Ones, about crazy Joey Gallo and the revolution at the edge of the underworld. Let's hear a little bit of Bob Dylan's song, Joey. And when we come back, we'll talk about the accuracy of this song, which is hard because, Bob Dylan is just trying to create a picture, and also Joey Gallo liked to burnish his own image. That's all coming up on WNYC. Stay with us.
Opened up his eyes to the tune of an accordion. Always on the outside of whatever side there was. We'll be right back.
Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, and we're speaking with Tom Folsom, the author of The Mad Ones, who wrote a book about Joey Gallo, the subject of that song by Bob Dylan off the album Desire. So if you looked at the lyrics of the song, they include such facts as that in later years, Joey wouldn't carry a gun because he's around too many children. And they talked about reading Nietzsche and Attica. How accurate is the song? Because Dylan has been criticized for the accuracy thereof.
Yeah, I don't think you want to read it just, you know, on a strictly factual basis. But, you know, I do think he does capture, you know, he really captures that lyrical, almost operatic quality of the Gallo Brothers story.
So Joey Gallo starts reading different philosophies. He goes to Attica, has a lot of time on his hands, you know, is steeped in Nietzsche, is steeped in Immanuel Kant. He comes back and he wants to be a philosopher gangster. He doesn't renounce his life. He wants to be a new kind of gangster we've never seen before. How's that go?
Not so well. Yeah. Well, he had about I'd say about a year and a half to try it out. You know, he tells his parole officer when he's coming out of the joint after 10 years in 1970 that he wants to get into show business and make some real money. So why does a guy like Gallo think he's going to be able to get into show business? Well, you know, why not? All of a sudden, you know, the gang that couldn't shoot straight is made into a film. You know, this is based on the Gallo Brothers. Some of the best stuff in The Godfather, which is a phenomenon, is based on the Gallo Brothers. You've got, you know, sleeping with fishes. That's straight out of the Gallo story. Going to the mattresses. So I think Joey's almost thinking, well, you know, if all these guys are going to make a buck off me, well, you know, I'm going to make a buck myself.
Right. I mean, to the point where we know of The Godfather was a successful movie and a good movie, but, you know, your book has some details. Like, at the time, they were thinking of opening a chain of Godfather pizzerias and selling Godfather lemon ices. And it was bigger than The Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter or any of the, you know, so-called blockbusters of today.
It was a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I think in the wake of this phenomenon, I mean, this is, you know, this is right around the same time as Leonard Bernstein's Radical Chic. So all of a sudden, you have this kind of willingness, let's say on the Manhattan's Upper East Side, to hobnob with people who society have deemed outlaws. Well, you know, all of a sudden you watch The Godfather and you look at the Corleone boys, you know, Michael and Fredo and Sonny. They look like good boys here. So I think that they're thinking maybe there's something, you know, that we haven't, you know, we've been giving these guys a bad rap.
It would be, perhaps people think it would be fun and thrilling to be friends with a gangster. And in fact, a guy who really did become his friend was Jerry Orbach, the actor who played him in the movie. He played him like a buffoon in The Gang Who Wouldn't Shoot Straight. Did he come to regret that?
Well, Jerry's, you know, he ended up becoming really good friends with Gallo. They were kind of partners in crime, let's say, in terms of you know, hitting the hot spots. They were regulars at Elaine's. And so, you know, I think Jerry said that he eventually, you know, at Joey's funeral, you know, he made some sort of remark around the time that, you know, he was very wrong in the way he had played Joey Gallo, because he thought he was a very, you know, kind of engaging and interesting man.
And it does strike me, since this whole story takes place in and around New York, there might be a lot of people in the audience who have had a personal interaction with Joey Gallo. And if so, we invite you to give us a call at 212-433-9692. Again, 212-433-9692. If you have a Joey Gallo story that goes beyond the ones chronicled in The Mad Ones by Tom Folsom, who we're talking to, let's assess some of the decisions of Joey Gallo and the gang. We chronicled how the kidnapping plot didn't really work out. They also kind of hunkered down in a big building in Red Hook, but they were under constant police surveillance. I wonder how much they could maneuver and actually get the things done to make them money. How did that work out?
Well, it was, you know, they're basically in a state of siege, yeah. You know, like guys in the Alamo here, right on the Red Hook waterfront in their grandmother's three-story, you know, dilapidated tenement. This is kind of devastating to their rackets. They're really not able to go out and earn any money, because they are under not just 24/7 surveillance by the NYPD and the FBI. They've also got the Profaci family, who's encircling Red Hooks like sharks and Cadillacs, let's say, ready to pop them off if they stray too far from headquarters.
So at this point, maybe Gallo thought of his career as in whatever, his nation career or his supposed career as an author or as a movie star, just a way to get out of a business that wasn't really making him much money, right? I mean, was he making money from the rackets at the time?
Well, no. I mean, and all of a sudden, I think he realizes that show business is a great racket.
Yeah.
And I think he's also looking at his Don Joe Colombo, who started the Italian-American Civil Rights League. And, you know, to Joey, you know, that was a racket. He figured that Colombo was taking all those these donations by honest people and use it to his, you know, to build his empire.
And in fact, and this was a detail of the book that blew my mind, Joe Colombo was so brazen that he would organize his henchmen and gangsters to picket the FBI's office, which was then on the east side, and then they'd go have lunch at PJ Bernstein's. I can't believe the audacity.
Yes, that's part of the great irony. I mean, he actually did. He had a very true message, which is why should, you know, Italian Americans be branded in the media all the time as these kind of mobster types? But he's the proponent of this idea, and he is in fact, you know, a mafia don.
Yeah, and at the time, from, you know, talking to my father and my uncle, they did say that Joe Colombo was basically a household name, and his message, even though people debated if he was or wasn't a mobster, his message really was well received. There wasn't a lot of Italian American pride before him.
Sure, no, it's. I mean, he was. You know, he was very much had the right message, but the messenger. You know, there's something to be said about that.
Donnie, hi, Donnie. You know, you knew Joey. Welcome to WNYC. You knew Joey Gallo. Oh, you got to shut down the radio, Donnie, if you want to talk. Are you there?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, please turn down the radio and tell us about your interaction with Joey Gallo.
My interaction is through generations. It's an intergenerational story that when they had two botched attempts to kill him, but they finally did get him. He was from the neighborhood of President and Henry Street down in Red Hook. And I think what really rubbed them the wrong way was that he brought the ethnics into the mob. And they didn't like that about Joe.
Yeah, that's true. I think it did rub him the wrong way. And you write about, thanks for the call, Donnie. You write about it in the book. When he was in Attica, there was an incident where whites would only get their hair cut by a white barber, and blacks would only get their hair cut by a black barber. And Joey Gallo said, "This is stupid," and sat down in a chair to get his hair cut by a black barber. Is that what happened?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, Joey was doing some really kind of revolutionary things, let's say, in terms of how he wanted to push forward and organize crime. He made alliances with Harlem heroin dealer Nicky Barnes, realizing that you know if we have kind of this alliance of the streets, you know the Gallo brothers teaming up with these guys in Harlem, we could really take over the New York City underworld.
And the like Donnie the caller said, in your book you write about how others in the mafia kind of nervously joked about it. He's going to have a whole system of hitmen who used to be black nationals in prison with him.
Sure, and in the wake of these jokes, Joe Colombo is gunned down by an African American at one of his rallies in Columbus Circle. So immediately that's pinned on Joey Gallo.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. Bert from Manhattan, who knew Joey Gallo or maybe knew one of Joey Gallo's loves. Hello, Bert. You got to turn down the radio, Bert. Hi, Bert. Are you there with us? Can you hear us? All right. Sorry. If you call in to 212-433-9692, you do have to turn down your radio. All right. So the last caller did reference what rubbed the gang, what rubbed the established mafia the wrong way was, you know, in Donnie's opinion, it was his alliance with African Americans. Who knows what it was, but let's talk about how he bought it at the end. He had just seen Don Rickles play the Copa.
Yes. Well, so, this is we'll rewind for a second. This is April 6, 1972. This is Joey Gallo's 43rd birthday. So where are you going to go for your 43rd birthday? Well, you're going to go to the Copacabana. Joey gets decked out in his pinstripe suit. He's also got an open contract on his head from the mafia at this point. But he decides to go with his family, his wife of just 3 weeks. They gotten married. His stepdaughter and his new showbiz friends, including Jerry Orbach. So they're all hanging out at the Copacabana. And Joey's literally the toast of the town at this point. He's written up in Midnight Earl Wilson's New York Post columns. He's a real society item. As one socialite said, everyone who is anybody wants to meet Joey Gallo. So they're at the Copacabana, and they decide to have a late night snack. So they all pile into the Cadillac, and they head downtown to Little Italy. And they see a gleaming new restaurant called Umberto's Clam House. on Hester and Mulberry Street, and they decided to go in and have scongili salad. And very soon afterwards, Joey Gallo was gunned down.
And do we have any idea who did it?
That's one of these kind of great mafia mysteries. It's almost the Kennedy conspiracy. Once you start thinking that you know who it is, there's other facts. It was anywhere from one to three hitmen. We really don't know.
Let's take a call. I think Bert actually has turned down his radio. Hey, Bert.
Hey.
Oh, thanks for joining us, Bert. So who do you know of Joey Gallo or his life?
I went to high school with Joey Gallo's wife.
Now, he had two wives. Did you go to high school with is it Cena?
Yeah.
Cena or Jeffy?
Jeffy.
Jeffy. Okay. And what kind of woman was she like?
Oh, she was going with the kind of a hoodie kind of guy in high school at the time. He was a wrestler, kind of. He was, I don't know what nationality was, like a Hawaiian sort of guy.
Because I think in the book, Jeffy was more of a countercultural type influence on Joey, yeah.
What became of her?
Okay, we'll ask Tom. Thanks for the call, Bert. What became of his first wife?
She passed away recently. But Jeffy was really she kind of represented that beatnik world to Joey. You know, she had an apartment on 8th Street, strewn with books and about philosophy and records. So she's really Joey's entryway into Greenwich Village counterculture. She'd actually she was once even married to jazz great, Jerry Mulligan.
Mm. Phil from New Jersey. Hi, Phil.
Yes, good morning.
Go ahead, Phil. How did you know Joey Gallo, if you did?
My dad used to work for him. I'm black, and I used to live in Brooklyn down at Red Hook.
Uh-huh.
And he was part of the people that integrated the mafia. And he used to literally run numbers for him.
Whatever.
And,
what did your dad say?
For him. And I think, because my dad was kind of strong,
yeah,
he used to do some muscle work.
What kind of boss was Joey Gallo, did your dad say, if he talked about it?
He was a fair guy, except he got fired by him because he started taking some of the money from the number running.
Oh, yeah.
But that's another story.
Well, just getting fired instead of something worse, your dad.
Yeah, for sure, it was fine.
I think
my dad lived to be 92, so that's good.
Right, maybe just not being having knees broken, that was his severance package.
Yeah.
Not being severed.
I used to go around with him, made his questions, and I used to love it. I absolutely used to, so thrilling. I mean, I was a little kid and impressed by that, and that's not much of a father figure, but my dad was a great guy.
Oh, wow. And when you went around, did you get a lot of respect from people in the neighborhood?
Because he did.
Yeah, yeah.
He did.
And did you feel it was because you were somehow connected to the Gallos?
No, not me. I was a tiny tot. I was a kid. I was like 6 years old or something like that.
Got it. Well, thanks for the call, Phil.
All right, now.
Now, Phil mentioned that phrase, integrated the mafia. Is that true? Is that overstating it?
He tried to. It's, yeah. If he'd kept on it, well, he's, who knows what would have happened. But certainly, as you look at a guy like Nicky Barnes, he was making a killing off the heroin racket in the 1970s.
And the debate that was in The Godfather, whether to get into heroin or whether to keep it with a more respectable vice like gambling, that really was a debate going on at the time.
That was a debate, although it was less a point of honor than a point of, the feds are going to come after us with everything that they have if we start getting into heroin.
That wound up being true.
That was true, and that was, heroin was a really, The Godfather was correct in that stance. I mean, that was really the thing that started to erode the fabric of the Cosa Nostra.
And then there was also the fact that the idea of omerta, never telling people's business, was beginning to fall away. Was Joey, even though Joey Gallo was never a rat and never, told on anyone to officials, was the fact that he was so open and in the media seen as destroying some of that idea of omerta?
Well, sure. I mean, you've got a guy, like Carlo Gambino, who would, totally press phobic. That's the last thing he wants is attention. And you have Joey Gallo, who's decked out in this gangster suit, and he's holding these impromptu press conferences, like some sort of underworld Lenny Bruce outside of the courthouse. He's making wisecracks. He's totally playing into the media image. The Gallo brothers even invited Life magazine to come and do a photo shoot of them. This is the largest magazine in America. And all of a sudden, they've got this full spread on the Gallo brothers. So this was very much seen as an embarrassment to the five families.
Did the other people in the mafia think of the Gallos as, very something very to take very seriously, more of a pebble in the shoe, a joke?
I don't think that they were seen as a joke. I mean, these guys really did shake up the entire fabric of the Cosa Nostra in the 1960s. And in some degrees, their revolution against the mafia was, you know, successful in the long term because they really did, you know, erode this kind of ironclad hierarchy, codes, rules, structures. The Gallo brothers were the ones that really started to unravel that.
So it became more of a what they would consider a meritocracy. Those who earned or those who, you know, killed annoying people would get more rewarded after the Gallo brothers?
Well, I don't know what you would call it, but I think the Gallo brothers just wanted to be on top one way or another.
Yeah, yeah. And what happened to Larry and Kid Blast after Joey was killed?
Larry, he died of cancer in the 1960s. That's what ended up getting him. And Kid Blast is reportedly still around somewhere.
Were the Gallo brothers a functioning, you know, mob unit after Joey was killed?
It started to dissipate.
Yeah. I think Eileen from Queens has a Gallo family connection. Go ahead, Eileen. Hello.
Hi. I'm just asking a question. When I was a very little girl, I lived on Essex Street between Blake and Sutter. And on the corner of Blake and Essex Street, there was a grocery store called the Gallo Brothers. And around the block on Blake Avenue was another underworld character called Ralph Scarpia. And I was wondering if that was the same family.
Well, were the Gallo Brothers ever bold enough to put their name on a grocery store?
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah.
The wine's not theirs either.
No.
That's Ernest and Julia, different Gallo Brothers. although, you know, reading the book, there are a lot of connections to legitimate businesses. Kaplan Buick was owned by, was it the Columbos?
Yeah, Joe Colombo and Kaplan Buick.
And
Prospero Funeral Home.
Prospero Funeral Home. Big importer. I mean, they still import Bailey's Irish Cream and J&B Scotch. Something called Peerless Imports was owned by, I think, Joe Profaci's brother-in-law. That might have been. He was constantly hauled in to answer questions. I don't know if anything was ever, you know, put on him. In writing the book, did you base it more on previously written accounts, the transcripts of things like the Senate hearings or first-person interviews that you did?
It's an amalgam of all that. One of the real treats that I got was 1,500 pages that the FBI graciously gave me through FOIA, just all on Joey Gallo. This has got, you know, wiretaps. This has got daily reports from FBI guys, blow-by-blows of the mafia war that they're sending, you know, directly to J. Edgar Hoover. So for a writer, this is just a treasure trove.
Who are the most interesting people that you talk to who you wouldn't mind mentioning? Because maybe some of them said, keep my name out of it.
I talked to Chief Albert Seidman, who was a really, you know, for those who don't know, kind of the most colorful, chief of detectives of the NYPD. I was able to speak to him about his experiences investigating not just the Columbo shooting, but the Gallo murder.
All right, I want to take a quick call, and Joseph Gallo is calling us. Hello.
Hello.
So, what have things been like since you were gunned down in front of Umberto's clam house?
Well, that's very interesting that you should phrase it that way, because it's complete misery to have to go through a lifetime of being asked if I'm related to him.
Your name is literally Joseph Gallo. You ever think
it is literally Joseph Gallo?
You ever think of changing your name?
Sorry?
You ever think of changing it?
Why? No, I haven't. But I have had to defend myself for a lifetime. So, just so you know, at the end of the day, this man was a colorful character, a dramatic, great story. But you know, he's a criminal and he is a murderer, and don't forget that.
Thank you very much, Joseph Gallo.
Bye bye.
Yeah, and I think that it just goes to show Joey Gallo's victims continue on after his life. Well, thank you, Tom Folsom, the author of The Mad Ones, Crazy Joe Gallo and the Revolution at the Edge of the Underworld. It's published by Weinstein Books, which means a movie may very well be in the works. I know it's been optioned. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thank you.